when you think about like an ideal neighborhood, like a neighborhood that you'd really want to live in, what is that neighborhood like?
Where there's no shooting, it's a whole bunch of kids. They have like parties, block parties, nice houses, no abandoned houses.
How does that compare to your neighborhood where you live now?
That neighborhood is everything that ours is not.
That is Tariana Graham. She's 11. She and her family live in northeast Detroit, in the Osborne neighborhood. Their bungalow sits 4 blocks south of 8 Mile, with the suburb of Warren on the other side.
Whether it's 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night, you may need to carry around her.
And that's Terrence, Tariana's dad. Her mom, Patrice, says if she wants to work out, she'll drive 4 miles to a park in St. Clair Shores.
We used to go up to Osborne, but I used to go up to Osborne. I used to walk with my gun.
What was it that made you decide that you wanted to get a license?
Every time we looked up, it was somebody getting carjacked, somebody getting robbed, and they was hitting women, 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 women. And I just decided to go ahead and get licensed.
This routine violence, the robberies, the assaults, the homicides, it's not new. And of course, it's not just limited to Detroit.
My cousins who live in Kentucky say the same things are going on there. So it's just the world, period. Right now it's corrupt.
But it might be surprising to hear, nationally, crime rates have been falling since the early 90s. And in 2015, Detroit had its lowest homicide rate in decades. But still, the city's murder rate remains 10 times the national average. And last year, Forbes named Detroit the nation's most dangerous city.
Another horrible story of gun violence in Detroit. Tragedy inside this home over the weekend.
2 days after a father is shot and killed in front of his kids, police still don't have anyone in custody.
A 6-month-old baby shot and killed when a man opens fire on a group of children on Detroit's west side over the weekend.
Whether you live amid the violence, like the Grahams, or just hear about it on the news, it can be easy to take for granted, to think of it as inevitable. This is historian Heather Ann Thompson.
Well, basically, we've just normalized that murder is part of inner city existence, or it's part of the existence of poor communities. And by normalizing it and making it seem as if it's just synonymous with inner city living, we totally miss the fact that this is a created crisis, that the drug war and mass incarceration together have created the conditions where violence is not only regular, but actually guaranteed.
The fact is, life in Detroit has not always been this way. And later in this hour, we'll meet people who say it doesn't have to be this way. People like activist Sandra Hines.
It's time for us to really, let's turn the news around from where every day when we turn on the news is somebody being killed to somebody planted a garden and look at what the outcome was. We cannot wait another day because every day we wait, we see 4 and 5 more people killed. We want to create peace. We want Detroit to be created as a peace zone.
But before we look beyond the violence, we're going to look right at it. From Michigan Radio, you're listening to a State of Opportunity documentary. I'm Zach Rosen. There's a little flower shop on Detroit's east side, right on Gratiot Avenue. You gotta ring the buzzer to get let inside. The walls are painted lime green and they're lined with glass-doored refrigerators, packed with flowers. Koresh Florists has been around for over 60 years, and Carol Richard has worked here for nearly that entire time.
I started here when I was 16 years old, and I'm 72. I've been here 56 years.
What was it like when you first started here?
We used to be open 7 days a week till 9 o'clock every night. The neighborhood was different. I mean, we hate to say that it's gone down, but now we have to have bars on the windows and.
Richard went to high school down the street.
there was no fear of walking around here, and, you know, in and out and no problem, and the neighbors were good and everything was good. And but things have changed over the years, and, you know, some for the better and some for not so good.
And so what was it that made you stop feeling comfortable walking in the area?
There was a murder in the park next door to us. And when the police came around and started asking questions and whatever, that was kind of scary. Up until that point, I don't think that there was really anything that I was worried about before, but when somebody gets murdered right next door to you, it kind of shakes you up a bit.
And when you get a call for a funeral, how does that work?
It's a casket spray, a standing spray, a floral arrangement in a vase, a pillow for inside the casket, and a boutonniere or corsage, depending, of course, if it's a man or a woman that passed away. And that total delivered is $220.94.
Here at Koresh, Carol Richard and her colleagues make a lot of floral arrangements for funerals. She estimates at least 10 a week.
We did that one, I don't remember the young fellow's name that was murdered, taken from the party store over on East Warren, and then they found him a couple of days later. We did his flowers.
On the counter near the cash register, there are a dozen binders, each filled with Polaroids of arrangements they've done. In the middle of one binder, there's a SpongeBob SquarePants display, a yellow pom-pom body, daisies painted black for the feet, white styrofoam eyes. Richard doesn't know the story of whomever's funeral the SpongeBob was for, but it was likely a child.
But a lot of times we don't ask because they're very emotional, and sometimes we know that it's for a child, but a lot of times we don't.
It's a blisteringly hot summer afternoon in Detroit. East Lafayette Street is blocked off from car traffic. A few hundred people walk together down the middle of the street. Some of them carry signs with photographs of the victims of gun violence. There are posters that read, "Thou shall not kill." On the sidewalk, there's a pastor holding a megaphone. It's Pastor Barry Randolph from the nearby Church of the Messiah. Andrea Clark is in the middle of the pack. She's wearing red and white, like she always does. She says the red represents blood, and the white, an angel. Today's event is far from her first anti-violence march.
I've probably been to, I would say, over 50.
Clark is the founder of the group Mothers of Murdered Children.
Well, we have a child that was murdered for his Cartier glasses coming out of a club in downtown Detroit. We have a son that was murdered during a 4th of July celebration. We have baby Delrick Miller's family, who he was 6 months old, laying on his couch, and the house was shot up.
Andrea Clark started the group in 2011, 3 months after her own son, Darnell Perkins, was killed.
I needed a reason to live. I needed a reason to go on. I needed a reason to see the world in a different light. So, I began to pray, and God gave me the vision for Mothers of Murdered Children, because I didn't want them to feel like I felt. I wanted them to know that somebody else feels what you feel and somebody's there with you. You're not alone in all of this grief.
It's been 5 years since Clark lost her son. Today, she's grown Mothers of Murdered Children into a group of 45 active members.
I wanted the mothers to become sisters, to be able to share the most intimate pain that they're feeling. After losing their child, and know that they have an arm, a hand, and a shoulder to hold on to.
The group meets every other Saturday at that same Eastside church that organized the rally, Church of the Messiah.
All of our children matter. And in Mothers of Murdered Children, we don't judge, and it doesn't matter how your child was murdered, whether he was the drug dealer or the man standing on the corner and got robbed for his glasses or whatever. All mothers who have lost a child to violence and to murder, I welcome them in our group. because our children are on the same level right now. They're not here.
So if we could start with you, Lakita, you want to end, just introduce yourself.
Clark spends a lot of her time checking in with the members. A lot of the moms are still waiting for their children's killers to be caught. She's also working to get homicide declared a public health crisis. That would help get federal money allocated for mental health treatment. After all, around 60% of people in jails and prisons are suffering from some kind of mental health issue. But one of the most important things that the moms do together is grieve.
It all started on October 3rd, 2011.
January the 7th, 2012, I believe.
July the 24th, 2012.
They gather here to move through their pain with people who can relate to it. As a group, they represent just a tiny percentage of the devastation that homicide brings to a community. It's been years since some of these moms lost their children. For others, it's been just a few months. But no matter how long it's been, Mothers of Murdered Children reminds us that pain and trauma lives on in the wake of all the death.
My son, Dan Adams Jr., was murdered on the streets of Detroit.
That's the win out of me, to speak about it.
My son is Justin Williams. He was murdered at a fireworks party at a park around the block from his grandparents' home.
He was sitting on a front porch of his friend's home. There was a drive-by. He was shot 4 times in the chest.
You're listening to a State of Opportunity documentary. Coming up, Martinez Wilson's story.
I don't know if this was a drug house or not, but you seen a lot of traffic in the morning when I would drop her off at school. And this is her bus stop.
That's Patrice Wilson Graham. I introduced you to her and her family at the top of the hour. Even though their daughter Tariana's bus stop is just 2 blocks from their house, they don't feel comfortable letting her walk by herself.
You know, you don't know if they're going to be running from bullets, speeding cars up the street. We even have guys walk up and down the street with firearms.
Hi, Tariana. How was school today? What was the focus today? Did you have homework? I mean, it's so dangerous, not just the gun violence, but just the people who just don't have a heart anymore.
When we moved over here, it was beautiful. It wasn't not one abandoned house over here. And at the time, you know, we was very young and eager to buy our new home. So that's what we were looking forward to. And now, you know, I just want to get my family into living a better life in a better neighborhood.
The Grahams moved to Detroit's Osborne neighborhood over 10 years ago. They wanted to be closer to Terrence's family. He grew up around here. But now all of his extended family has moved out of the neighborhood, and Terrence and Patrice remain in the house they bought for nearly $80,000. They moved in just before the foreclosure crisis decimated so much of Detroit.
It's a very, very rough neighborhood with not much to look forward to around here. You know, abandoned house after abandoned house. I mean, if you just go from these 2 blocks here, you're going to find at least about 12 abandoned houses. It's very rough.
Patrice says they'd love to move.
It's just time to go. It's just really time for a remake.
But there's no way they can sell their 900 square foot home for anything near what they paid. The house next door to them, which looks pretty similar, is on the market for $7,400. But despite all the empty homes that surround them, despite the speeding cars, and feeling like they always have to be looking over their shoulders, despite all that, the Grahams were doing relatively well. Patrice and Terrence are happily married and living together. That's in a city with a single-parent household rate of 74%. They both have jobs. Patrice is a nurse, and Terrence manages a kitchen at Applebee's. They were doing everything they could to etch out a safe and loving existence for their 3 kids, Trinity, Tariana, and Martinez.
Every day when I look at them, you know, I just fear for the world that we live in with them, you know. Like, I know they eventually have to grow up and go out, move out on their own. But as a parent, you want to be able to protect your children from everything.
But of course, that's impossible. And on June 15th of this year, everything changed.
An overnight shooting on Detroit's east side left two men dead and a third in the hospital.
Detroit police got the call around 3 a.m.
The scene, a horrifying bloodbath.
All that remains of the crime scene from this morning are the chalk marks on the ground where Detroit police found the shell casings from two guns.
A woman told police she was inside her home. She heard someone yelling. Then she heard gunfire.
She heard about 30 gunshots.
The three victims were found inside a car nearby.
The gunman lay in wait. Two different weapons used, one of them an AK-47, the other a 40 caliber handgun. The incredible volley fired at point-blank range. Two men died instantly. Martinez Wilson and Nathan Moldsley of Detroit. A third, 31-year-old Christopher Miles, remains in the hospital in temporary serious condition. Apparently the only living witness, and police definitely would like to speak to him as soon as possible. Martinez Wilson's parents came to the scene and wept openly, mourning their young son's passing.
He wasn't a thug. He wasn't this. My baby, he was just trying. When one thing fails, you try something else.
Taking lives, and it don't even matter whether it's black lives, white lives. People don't matter about lives anymore. They just don't care about life. And that's sad.
Indeed, it is sad. Detroit police do not have any suspects in this case. They're stumped, actually, because they say that these three men worked together at a local chain restaurant and don't know how it is or why it is that they ended up being gunned down so brutally in this fashion. Back to you.
Martinez was Terrence and Patrice's oldest child. He was 20 when he was killed this past spring.
You know, a lot of times in situations like this, you'll hear parents all the time say that their child was innocent, they was good, and you know, things of that sort. Because, you know, you want to say good things about your children, you know, but Martinez, he was actually that, you know. He never was out here stealing or taking from anyone. He wasn't raised that way. He had everything he needed. He never sold drugs or anything. You know, he came out of high school, went right to work. You know, he had two jobs, car, paying insurance. He was very, very responsible for his age, very responsible. So when we say that, we're not just saying that because we his parents.
Martinez, just like his dad, worked at Applebee's.
He actually went into the same restaurant that I started in, the same exact position that I started in, mastered the same exact grill that I mastered. He did every single thing that I did, you know, and I'm just very proud that he took all of the good things and he molded it into him. And he became a man way quicker than I ever could have even wished for him.
When people die, you see stuff about them on Facebook. You see people make a post and then you don't see them no more. Somebody posts or reposts Martinez every single day. He got two pages that are live wire every day. One of his buddies that he did raps with, he posts a rap video and songs every single day. So he has it's so much. Let me see. As you can see, this is just 10 hours ago, one of his friends put, "Rest up, teeny boy. Love your brother for life. Blood." Then right here is a video of him at Applebee's acting silly with his coworkers.
That's
him laughing. That laugh.
Terrence pulls up a video of a song Martinez wrote and performed. When he plays it, Patrice gets up and walks to the other room. She says it's too painful for her to hear it.
One thing my parents always taught me is to be your own person. As long as you got God, you should never be nervous. When I see my little sister, I tell her that I love her. Family is everything, do my best to protect her.
It's been over 4 months since Martinez was killed. The Detroit Police Department said they couldn't discuss any of the case details with me. They did say, quote, "This case is still open and very active. What I can tell you is that we currently do not have anyone in custody, and we are aggressively following all leads.
What would it do for you to get for the detective to call you one day and tell you that they found the guy? Why is that so important?
It's so important because my baby was innocent. And I feel as though that person, that heartless person who went over here and just sprayed up this car not knowing who you were attacking or who was there, needs to pay for what they done.
I would live a whole lot better and be able to heal better knowing that they was brought to justice. That's what I'm holding on to. Like, I plan to have that day.
It's coming. I feel it. I just feel like it's coming.
Just a few weeks ago, from an office tower in Southfield, Michigan, the Grahams made a plea.
As his father, I stand here today pleading to you to reach out to us and to Crime Stoppers. Someone you know something, and we just ask that you come forward.
That's Terrence speaking to a bank of cameras. His family and Martinez's friends and former co-workers stand behind him. They're all part of a press conference put on by Crime Stoppers of Michigan. You've probably seen the Crime Stoppers billboards before.
It's no sugarcoating it right now that our city is in a crisis right now. Our neighborhoods is destroyed, and we're losing many young men. I don't want to see another young man and another family like me and my wife have to go through the long nights that we suffer right now with the loss of our son.
The Detroit Police Department reached out to the nonprofit, hoping a press conference might generate some anonymous tips on Martinez's case. That third victim in the car with Martinez, Christopher Miles, he did survive. But detectives still haven't found the shooters.
Hi, my name is Tracy Taddy. I worked with Teenie at Roosevelt Applebee's.
Teenie was Martinez's nickname.
We had our secret handshake. He made work so amazing. All I ask is that somebody please, please come forward, because if it was your family, you would want the same exact thing.
Local TV and radio will play excerpts of today's press conference, and the footage will be sent out to every prison in the state, along with probation offices all over Southeast Michigan.
He didn't deserve to die this way.
That's Patrice.
One of his friends' mom couldn't afford to take him to send him off to prom. Martinez paid his way for him to go to prom.
I catch up with Terrence after the press conference, and he says now, more than ever, he's determined to move the family out of their house.
Yeah, it's even more so now. We always wanted to get them out of the neighborhood, but even more so now, like she says, the memories of the house and the neighborhood and just knowing that, you know, how he grew up around there, it's just overwhelming right now, you know. And we still got our girls that we gotta make sure they don't go through these kind of things.
Just a few months before Martinez was killed, Patrice and Terrence welcomed their third child into the world, Trinity.
Hi, Bo. Hey, Bo Padova.
Oh, no smiles?
She depends on me, and if I didn't have her who depended on me, maybe I would be in a different state, but I thank God that I have her to take care of so that my mind is not so wrapped around my son.
Trini. Hey, Boba Doopa. Hey.
You took a 10-minute nap. Oh, okay.
Between work and the new baby, Patrice and Terrence have their hands full. But that hasn't stopped them from taking on a new project inspired by their late son. Terrence remembers this one night a few years ago. Martinez was a junior in high school at the time, and the two of them stayed up all night talking, plotting, really. What if they started an organization, a brotherhood, that would help young men find their purpose? Patrice, Martinez's mom, had started a similar organization, but for young women, and now the boys wanted to make their own thing. Martinez was already a dedicated cook at the time, and he wanted to train other young men in the culinary arts, and eventually, with help from his dad, open a restaurant. But Martinez Wilson didn't live long enough to make those dreams come true.
In June, everybody know, obviously, we lost him to gun violence out here in these streets, and it inspired me to come back with men of purpose, because it identifies every single thing that went wrong.
That's Terrence speaking to his cousins and his nephews and Martinez's friends. After Martinez died, he finally started the organization he and his son had talked about. It's called Men of Purpose.
Men of Purpose is designed to help these guys find their purpose in life, show them another way. So I reach out to, I started it off with actually my son, all of his young friends in his past, and they all were looking for something different, and I began with them. And I just started to branch out. And like I said, it was designed to go after the younger generation, but I actually have older guys that are still looking for their purpose that came along and joined it. So we're here to mentor them, get them into enrolled in programs that they want to finish schooling, trades, and just help them find their purpose in life.
9 guys showed up to the most recent Men of Purpose gathering. They meet at the Samaritan Center on the far east side of Detroit. Terrence brought 4 hot and ready pizzas for the proceedings. And today, he's talking about fear and how it's important as a man to talk about fear.
My fear, my biggest fear right now, it changed from once before. My fear was, having to bury my kid. Okay, that fear, that nightmare happened. No, and as much as that nightmare seemed like the worst nightmare that could ever happen in your life, you know, now I'm faced with an even bigger fear, because I always thought that if something happened to me, you know, I had my son to be able to take care of my girls. You know, now I'm so fearful that if something happened to me, who's going to take care of them?
After Terrence talks for a bit, he tries to get the other guys to open up. This is James Payne.
Honestly, it started with us. Like, we got to make the change ourselves, because a lot of people my age, they could talk about it. Like they want to do it, but they don't really want to put in the work. So it started with us, because if we start and make a change ourselves, then the kids coming up under us, they change too.
Terrence keeps digging. He wants the guys to talk about what they want to work on, what they're insecure about. This is Donald Jones.
You know, when you married and you got a family to take care of, and you got people looking at you for certain things, and you can't supply those things at the time that you need them, mm-hmm. It kind of bruises your ego.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that too.
Absolutely.
So.
Terrence says the group is just getting started. He's in the process of getting the guys who don't have any work into job training programs.
It won't never cost you nothing but time, and in the mix of it, it'll get you self-development and put you where you need to be. I would never, ever ask anybody in this room for a dime. Only thing I want to do is give, and I want to be able to get us to a point where we give to others, and we reach somebody, and we stop. We might not be able to stop everything that's going on in the world, but I figure if we can take 20 guys to come amongst us and we give them something else to do besides firing, we saving somebody else, another father, another mother, from having to go through what we went through. So that's my mission, and that's my journey. And you know, no matter, like I said before, no matter if this room cleared today, you know, I still be here.
From Michigan Radio, you're listening to a State of Opportunity documentary. I'm Zach Rosen. Coming up in 10 minutes, Peace Zones for Life.
We want to create peace. We want Detroit to be created as a peace zone, not to be looked at a city of murder, but a city of survival, where the people survived and overcame all this crime and all this violence. And so we might as well jump in as a community and save our community.
Before the break, we went inside Terrence Graham's new organization, Men of Purpose.
I do this because this is something that's inside of me that I would not let die. I made a promise, and I'm gonna stick to it. So
he's trying to get the guys in the group off the street and into jobs and job training programs. But even more than that, as the organization's name suggests, he's trying to help them figure out their sense of purpose. After losing his son to gun violence this summer, Terrence is preaching life. He wants the men in his group to value life, their own, their neighbors. But scholars Charles Bell and Heather Ann Thompson say that valuing life isn't just about changing hearts and minds. It's also about reckoning with structural forces. Forces that so profoundly determine outcomes and opportunity in Detroit.
Where are the jobs? The jobs are shipped out to the suburbs. The DDOT bus doesn't go to the suburbs. So if you want a job, you can't get one. Then you have 70% of the jobs that are in the city are occupied by people in the suburbs. So it's a socially constructed nightmare that forces everyday Detroiters to fight over a very small percentage of the remaining jobs here or travel into the underground economy to find work and provide for your family illegally. I'm Charles Bell. I'm a PhD candidate at Wayne State University, and I'm working on research on the school-to-prison pipeline, mass incarceration, and a host of other social inequalities.
Well, I grew up in the inner city in Detroit. I went to Cass Tech, and I every day would go to school and see just the level of devastation of the city around me. I'm Heather Ann Thompson. I'm a historian at the University of Michigan, and I work on questions of incarceration, history of mass incarceration.
I remember walking to school, seeing broken windows and broken streetlights, and just thinking that it would be impossible to overcome these barriers that were around me.
What made you think that?
Just looking around and never seeing any of my friends leave. Even the people that were really good at sports and the people that I thought were would get a scholarship to go to college and stuff like that, they did not.
Charles Bell graduated from high school in 2004. Conservatively speaking, that year, fewer than half of Detroit high school students graduated.
It was really difficult. I knew I had to go to school, and my parents told me that was the only way that I'd make it out of that neighborhood. I remember waking up. I would take the bus fare off the counter, and I would just think, you know, this could be it. I might not make it back home. And I'm walking through a neighborhood where there's no streetlights, there's dogs barking, there are people getting killed. I'm standing at the bus stop at, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I have to make it to school. I get on the bus. Two or three stops later, another kid gets on the bus. His shoes are gone because he just got robbed before school starts for his Jordans. That early in the morning, that happens all the time. And then you get to the school. You're getting searched. You have metal detectors and armed guards. They're harassing you. You know, why do you have that hoodie on? You know, I remember going to Denby and white t-shirts were a gang. You know, blue t-shirts were a gang. Red t-shirts were a gang. And it's like, what do I wear? You know, there's water falling from the ceiling. The floors were warped. The textbooks are old. And you're thinking, there's no way in hell I can make it and be a doctor or a scientist or anything productive from here. Not this school. Not here. So I might as well do what I know to survive. And that's where a lot of kids, they get recruited into the drug dealing industry because the education system fails them every day.
Just like with Prohibition, in an earlier moment in American history, we made illegal one of the very few economies, informal economies, available, particularly to deindustrialized neighborhoods that Detroit has so many of.
Officials are determined to crack down on crack, per dose, the cheapest, most potent, most addictive form of cocaine ever seen in this country.
To protect that trade, you have guns, and to feed your family, you're selling an illegal substance. It cannot possibly be. Young black and brown people in general just simply lose their moral compass, lose their tethering to family, to community, to rationality. This is bigger than that. So what is the history of that? And that very quickly led me to understanding this was a very clear policy choice we made, and for that reason, we can unchoose it.
And what are the choices that could be made policy-wise to change things?
Well, on the policy level, there's so many possibilities, ranging from rolling back the legislation that's connected to the drug war, mandatory minimums, three strikes, any number of legislative changes we could make. But I think that the change has got to be, at some level, much more fundamental. We need to start thinking about criminal justice the way that that most people think about dealing with their own children when they do wrong, which is if something terrible happened on the part of one of your children, you wouldn't lock them up. You wouldn't throw away the key. You wouldn't put them in solitary confinement. You wouldn't separate them from everyone they knew for 20 years. You would try to figure out what had created the crisis, what had created the problem, and work through some sort of restorative justice means for them to take responsibility for whatever that action was. So I think the bar is actually pretty low. I think it's actually pretty simple. Simply do unto others' children what you would do with your own.
What kind of context do you think we need in kind of unpacking what is happening in our city?
Well, basically, we've just normalized that murder is part of inner city existence, or it's part of the existence of poor communities. And by normalizing it and making it seem as if it's just synonymous with inner city living, we totally miss the fact that this is a created crisis, that the drug war and mass incarceration together have created the conditions where violence is not only regular, but actually guaranteed. And so, you know, it raises really important questions about if we're going to fix this, we in fact are not going to fix it by locking up these kids.
When you think about like an ideal neighborhood or an ideal street, what are some of the characteristics that come to mind?
The ideal block that I would love to live on is everyone working together. You know, some type of trade going on where no one's in need of anything. All the kids know each other.
What does it look like?
Homes occupied, fresh fruits and vegetables. The squirrels are happy, you know, walking around, chilling with us, you know, living in one. That's what it looks like, you know. Since the community, we all need each other, from the birds to bees to each other.
Does that exist anywhere?
Shit, not in America.
What Heather Ann Thompson describes as that normalization of violence, it's something 28-year-old Stevan Mosley can relate to.
Being from here, you know, he thinks things are normal, and they're really not. Like, hearing people getting killed every day, every night, you know what I mean? Our brothers killing each other for the lack of love of themselves, you know. You get kind of numb, you know, cause it's like a normal day, and it shouldn't be that way. We gotta love each other more.
When do you think you became numb?
Probably as a kid. I saw my dad get shot. So at a young age, you see violence, you know.
Where was that?
Highland Park. He was outside with my uncle at the time. It was after him. He sold drugs, so it went after him, apparently, and hit my dad. And I had to see that at a young age.
And what would it take for you not to be numb?
I don't know. I think unity, you know, people coming together and showing love more to our women and kids, you know, and each other, so. That would bring my numbness down. I guess more humanity, I guess, in me.
I met Stevan Mosley in an oasis, a place called Feed'em Freedom Farm. He works there.
I don't know. It's a little piece of heaven to me.
It sits on a handful of city lots.
All our lavender plants.
On a quiet residential street.
Our Concord grapevines.
Between Jefferson Avenue and the Detroit River.
Our marigolds.
The farm emerged in 2009. It's an exercise in self-determination. Feed yourself so you can free yourself. Feed'em Freedom. As a member of the Feed'em Freedom Collective, Stevan tends to the fruits and vegetables. He runs the social media accounts, organizes events.
Feet of Freedom is a place where people could come to learn and gather, you know. And I think everyone feels safe here when they come here. It kind of gets you away from all the BS that may be going on in your life outside of here.
On the Feed 'em Freedom farm, there's a family, three generations. The grandpa, Wayne Curtis, spends Saturdays teaching art to his grandkids.
I learn from them, but they learn from me also.
And to any neighbor who wants to come by.
Oh, let me see that. You finished? I like this.
Can I draw another one? Me too.
Today, the neighborhood artists are collecting leaves to use as inspiration for their fall paintings.
Look both ways before you cross the street.
Okay.
Look both ways. Do you see any cars?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
The grandpa, Wayne, he's a talented artist. He painted a lot of the murals on this street.
If you mix all the colors together, they're going to change into the same color.
As Wayne and Stefan and the kids are busy painting, Wayne's wife, Myrtle, gets dinner ready.
Whoa!
Hearty vegetable soup and biscuits, all from the local diner where their son works.
Doesn't that look great?
Saturdays at the farm are idyllic, utopic even. But utopias don't exist. We're in Detroit, a city that reported 295 homicides last year. That's why Feed 'em Freedom has been hosting a series of gatherings. They want to talk about the impact of all the violence and what they can do about it.
I just couldn't sit any longer and not pull people together who have like minds, who really are sincere, and who really want to do something for real.
That's Sandra Hines. She spent her entire life in Detroit. And for over 25 years, she's been part of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality.
We're not anti-police. We're anti-police brutality.
In 2004, Hines got a phone call. A young man named Dennis Crawford had been killed by the police. The coalition documented police brutality cases and worked with the families of victims as legal advocates. This particular case started after Crawford got into a fight with his girlfriend, and the girlfriend called the police.
When the police arrived, Dennis went to run through the back of the house to go out the back door, and she told the police he's running to the back. And when they got to the back, he was coming out, and they accosted him and engaged him in a battle, and they pulled their guns down and killed him right in front of his family.
But something else happened next, and it shifted how Hines thought about her work with the coalition.
Dennis's family, Mrs. Crawford, his mother and his sister, couldn't forgive the girlfriend for calling the police on Dennis, and they blamed her for Dennis's death. And so they put out the notion that they were going to take her out and her family.
Hines realized the coalition had to broaden its approach. They had to start looking at ways to end not only police violence, but also violence within the community and what feeds it.
You know, if you living under a lot of stress and a lot of pain, it's hard not to be angry and hostile sometimes in a lot of situations. And when you don't have anything, then you want to take from others, and that causes people to choose to commit crimes when I don't think they normally would if they had better housing, you know, better education and jobs.
And now, every month, Sandra Hines holds a meeting at Feed 'em Freedom to talk about peace.
It's time for us to really, you know, let's turn the news around from where every day when we turn on the news is somebody being killed to somebody planted a garden and look at what the outcome was. We cannot wait another day because every day we wait, we see 4 and 5 more people killed. We want to create peace. We want Detroit to be created as a peace zone.
A peace zone.
Not to be looked at as a city of murder, but a city of survival where the people survived and overcame all this crime and all this violence. And so we might as well jump in as a community and save our community.
What does it take to jump in and save the community? And what exactly is a peace zone?
So when I think of a peace zone for life, I think of neighborhoods where people are not having their water shut off at a very basic level, where people are not being foreclosed on their homes.
Kim Redigan showed up to the meeting representing the Michigan Meta Peace Team.
So I think when we look at street violence, we have to always look at the structural violence that's underneath it, and it all has to be addressed.
And what if they had a peace zone in their neighborhood? An actual space where people could come together to grow food and trade skills. A space where neighbors could resolve conflicts before they turned violent.
I just feel grief-stricken and heartbroken when I look on the news and see every day the deaths and just the disparity that people are operating and living out of because of all this violence and crime. You got to personalize it to how it affects your life and your family and your neighborhood. You know, you got to bring the neighborhood back.
As appealing as the peace zone is, you still have these greater forces at play, disjointed school system, you have foreklosures, massive unemployment.
You just got to keep doing it. You just can't give in. And you just got to keep it going. It's no magic way to do it. It's going to take a long time. And it's going to take a lot of work because things are not getting better. They're getting worse. And so it's an experiment. It's an experiment anyway. But we just got to keep plugging at it. We can't stop.
I declare this a peace zone because we were created for love and beauty and healing.
We have a right to safety and health. We have a right to families that without violence. We have a right to live life without violence.
I declare this a peace zone because God, we're all God's children, and we all want to live in peace and harmony.
And so what do we say to that? Peace!
Peace!
No, that's
not. Oh!
You've been listening to a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. Sarah Hewlett edited today's show. Zoe Clark is our executive producer. The State of Opportunity team includes Paulette Parker, April Van Buren, Dustin Dwyer, and Jen Guerra. Special thanks to Kenneth Reed, Julie Weatherhead, and Shira Heisler. And thanks to WDIV and Fox 2 Detroit. I'm Zach Rosen.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.